show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. We got some baseball things to talk about. We got some Royals things to talk about. And we will get to that in just a moment. But first, introductions. I am Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, is the man who has only one known Twitter burner account, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this evening? I am, of course, for those that don't know, referencing the owner of the Philadelphia 76ers, who it was found, who was discovered that he had multiple quote unquote burner Twitter accounts and was using them to throw out positive tweets about him, keep tabs on, and comment about his own players. So we're not going to get too in-depth into that, but that was
right
part of the introduction. So.
Yeah, I haven't used that burner account of mine for a while, and it's probably a good thing.
It's out there, though. We all know it's still there.
It is out there. It definitely is, but it's not one that I use, so or have reason to use, so it's fine. We're all good.
Fair enough. All right, so the Royals, we kept hoping and hoping that they would give us some more positive things to talk about, and sure enough, they kind of have. So within the last week and a half or so, 2 weeks, the Royals have actually started playing some decent baseball. They're 6-4 in their last 10 games, and kind of more encouragingly, I think, and maybe our first point that we'll start with today, we've had in the last week two very good, very encouraging starts from Danny Duffy. He pitched last night against the Twins. Or, I'm sorry, 2 nights ago against the Twins. Pitched 6 innings, only gave up 4 hits, 1 earned run, four strikeouts and 4 walks. So that's a little, could use some work, but baby steps here. The previous start before that against the Rangers, he pitched 7.2 innings, only gave up 4 hits again, only 1 earned run again, and had 5 strikeouts and 2 walks. So, you definitely would love to see those strikeout numbers be a little bit higher, but at this point, just getting Duffy back on track is numero uno thing to take care of. So, getting him going deeper into games, I mean, he'd only gone more than 6 innings once before. So that was pretty good of all his starts. So, encouraging signs from him going a little bit deeper into games, being a little bit more under control, having better, better stuff, better performance overall. So I was pretty encouraged by that. Did you? Unfortunately, I wasn't able to watch his start this past weekend or this past week. So were you able to catch much of what he's done? Are you encouraged as well?
Yeah. And that game against Texas was kind of like, he had kind of bottomed out there. He came into that game with a 6.88 ERA. We had just talked about, how many struggles he's had this year. And he goes out, and I think he gave up a hit to the leadoff hitter and didn't give up another hit until like the seventh at that point. So he was just, still kind of, the pitch count started to get up there as the game went along, but he really kind of looked a lot like that Duffy we saw in 2016, maybe without the strikeouts. So to even get a glimpse of that after some of the outings that he's had this year was very encouraging. And then to follow it up with another pretty solid game against the Twins, the walks, that's not great. And his pitch count is still kind of up there. You'd still like to see him be efficient and maybe go 7 innings on 108 pitches. But, you know, this is, at this point, he's got two starts in a row where he's allowed only one run. And considering that, you know, he's had so many games where he's given up five or more, I think that's a good thing. And for Duffy, who in so many different ways was taking this pretty personally, like, I mean, I don't think he's, like, lost his confidence, but, you know, he was definitely, like, you know, really kind of beating himself up in all of his comments because the Royals just were not playing well, and he wasn't pitching well. So to see some kind of positivity, I think that's definitely good. It's something to build off of. You know, he just has to look forward. He's got these two starts to kind of keep in his pocket, and if that bolsters him going into the next 4 months of the season and he pitches better, then that's going to be good for him. It's going to be good for the Royals. And, you know, I think everybody's going to be a lot more happy anytime he starts. Because, you know, there are a couple of those times where, you know, it was pretty rough to watch a Danny Duffy game because he just, you know, wasn't very effective. But if he's going to do this, I mean, that's a lot better. It's a lot easier to kind of to jump back on board and, you know, try to carve out some time to watch some of those starts when you have a little better feeling that he's not going to get hammered.
Yeah, because it, you know, he had crossed over that threshold to just kind of, sometimes you can have, you know, not the greatest result, but you can still, you know, you can still be Danny Duffy, the Danny Duffy that we have come to know these last few years when he's really been, you know, kind of close to the top of his game. But he had blown well past that point, and not only was he, you know, not getting the desired result, but he was pitching poorly. It just wasn't really fun to watch. It was kind of just uncomfortable, really, mm-hmm. because, you know, seeing someone struggle like that, and Danny Duffy's always very visible person when he struggles. You can see it on his face and his body language and everything. So it's, you know, it's not fun to watch when those types of things are happening. But hopefully, you know, with two good performances in a row, you know, he's getting himself back on track. I mean, it's super encouraging, like you said, to see that 7.2 inning performance there, and just, you know, really kind of look more like his older self. And whenever you have a good performance like that, I'm always that much more tuned into the next performance, you know, from a metaphorical sense, obviously. Because I unfortunately wasn't able to watch his most recent start. But, you know, being in that position where you've had a good start, what about the next one? Can you follow it up? You know, because I feel like, how many times did we go through that with Luke Hochaver when he was still trying to, to be a starter, right? You know, he'd pitch eight innings, give up one run or no runs and strike out nine or something like that. You know, just have a fantastic game. We're like, hey, this is it. We can turn it around.
He's,
you know,
turned the corner.
How many times did we hear that? And then, you know, he'd come out and give up five runs in the first inning, barely get it out. So, you know, as good as it is, or as important as it is to get that first game of performing well under your belt, it's almost equally as important to follow it up with another good game so that you can start to trust yourself a little bit more, get some of that momentum back, etc. So that was definitely very encouraging. I don't want to fall short of saying that he's, you know, quote unquote fixed, because I never really thought that he was, you know, broken really in the first place. I mean, there was some talk of possible injuries or whatever, but, you know, he was just going through a rough spot. Unfortunately, it was really, really rough. So yeah. I'm hoping that he's able to come out of it, and he's showing some signs right now. He's moving forward, getting to a better place. So hopefully he can continue that, because good Danny Duffy is exciting to watch. And it did, you know, one more fun thing to watch while all this, you know, when the Royals are not quite competing.
Yeah. I mean, you got to hang on to something, and Duffy being good is, I think it's good for everybody, because we can kind of like take a deep breath, chill out a little bit. It's going to be okay. You know, his career track record has generally been good. Year to year, he's always above average. And in some years he's very, very good. And this year he hasn't been good, but he's still got 4 months to turn things around and get back onto the right side of things. And, you know, if these two starts lead him then in that direction, then that's great. And he's not the only – I mean, you know, the Royals won two games for him, whereas through the whole month of April they didn't win at all when he started. Another guy like that, Jason Hamill, the Royals didn't win a single one of his starts in all of April, and his last two starts he's pitched very well also. He's got 16 strikeouts and two walks in the last two starts combined. Gave up one run total. He could have pitched even more in that first game. He pitched 7 innings, 6 strikeouts, no walks. It was in St. Louis, though, and I think he was lifted for a pinch hitter.
The old double switch, Ned. When Ned gets that opportunity again to use it, he takes it.
Yeah, yeah. NL baseball, it's so pure.
It's a thing.
Thanks.
so pure. It's the soul of the game is what it is.
Yeah, but, I mean, he only had 89 pitches through 7 innings, and he definitely could have thrown another inning. And then he came out and had 10 strikeouts the day after, or the start after that. So that's encouraging again because, you know, he entered that start in St. Louis with an ERA over 6 as well, and he carved off a full run just on 2 good starts. So, you know, for Hamill, it's a little bit different because we're talking more about, like, maybe potential trade value. He might not have a whole lot because, you know, he's Jason Hamill and he's kind of a known thing. It's not, you know, half
he's
season
an
also Jason
ran
Hamill.
At this point.
Yeah, I mean, he's a nice number 5 for a playoff team that maybe had an injury. You know, perfectly feasible, but it's like you're not going to get a top 100 prospect for Jason Hamill. But if you can get, you know, an A-ball guy who's younger than 24, and maybe you have something in a few years. Or maybe you're just trading him for some double-A guy who's 27 and, you know, never goes past triple-A. You never know. But
who knows?
These kind of starts, they kind of help boost his trade value a little bit. And, you know, in the next 2 months, that's going to be kind of the thing to watch for him is that, you know, it's more about building up his trade value so that the Royals can maximize some return so that either they trade him straight up or he's a nice complimentary piece in a bigger deal that maybe gets them a better prospect coming back. So if he's pitching well, they can do that. If he's not pitching well, they probably can't trade him at all. So that's really what it comes down to. So that's the Jason Hamill side of thing, you know, which – I hate to put it in those terms because, you know, you like to root on everybody, but really it's like I want these guys to do well so that the Royals can get better value in 2 months for them. And Hamill definitely falls into that category.
Sure. So, you know, it's we'll kind of see how that develops. And it's going to be interesting because the Royals have a lot of people and they should be working the phones, and I believe that they are already, to start these conversations for trade talks. Now, I heard Jeff Passan on the radio on my way home from work, and unfortunately, he brought up a really good point that I hadn't really thought about, and he was talking about, you know, in the American League, and then you know, talking about all the Royals, but specifically the player that spurred this particular part of the discussion was John Jay, who's, you know, been playing really well, and you know, he's hitting .307. He had 43 hits in the month of, I think in the month of May.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was 43. Yeah. So, cause I threw me off, threw me off a little bit cause we're still technically in the month of May, but,
right.
He did have, he still had 43. So, you know, he's looking pretty good. He's playing as well as you would expect or as well as you could hope a John Jay would play. So,
yeah.
Decent trade target, right? You got an outfielder who's got center field experience who can get on base and, you know, is a solid player. You know what you're getting with him. There's some value in that. But back to the point I was talking about with that Passan was making that was really interesting that I hadn't thought about was if you really break it down, right? If you go back and look, or if not go back, but if you look at, you know, where all the standings are right now and you try and assess, okay, who's going to be your trade targets? Who, regardless of take positional need out of it right now, just who would need something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you pretty much know at this point, Boston and New York are going to be coming out of the East. right, for the for the playoffs. Most likely, Cleveland is going to take the Central, and similarly, most likely, Houston will be taking the West. So those are all pretty close to standard. And then, you know, Minnesota's likely not going to be making a move. The White Sox definitely aren't. The Royals obviously are not. Mm-hmm. Detroit probably isn't, in terms of trying to acquire somebody else. Texas likely isn't. Oakland, I mean, are they? I don't know. Baltimore's out. Toronto's probably out. So you're left with Seattle, Los Angeles Angels, and Tampa Bay. And is Tampa Bay really in that market either? You know, I mean, they're technically, you know, they're 2 games above 500 now, but they're 7 games back, 7.5 games back, or no, sorry, 8 games back of the Yankees, and another 2 games back of the Red Sox, 10 games behind them. So, and that's already, you know, and we're only 54-ish games into the season. So your trade targets really, you're probably going to take Tampa Bay out of that equation. So your trade targets are really Seattle and Los Angeles. And, you know, what do they have to give up? Who are they going to give up? Or what are they going to want? Do they need a John Jay? Do they need a Mike Moustakas, Kelvin Herrera? Who knows? You know, Kelvin Herrera seems to be the he's definitely the best trade chip that they have, because regardless of whether or not you need a closer, everyone could always use a good reliever, especially from what we've seen for recent teams and their playoff success being so dependent upon bullpens. So Kelvin Herrera, whoever is in the market to try and improve their team, Kelvin Herrera has got to be up there on the top of the list. I mean, unless you just have an absolute lights out bullpen and you really do not need any more help, which offhand, I don't know if there's any team quite like that in baseball right now.
I don't know.
But unless you're that team, you know, unless you're the 2015 Royals, trying to acquire a bullpen pitcher at the caliber of Kelvin Herrera is going to make you better and is going to put you in a better position come playoff time. But, you know, so that's unfortunate from the American League side. But then you go into the National League side, and there's quite a few more trade partners. But of course, you know, then you start getting into, you know, National League Baseball and, you know, who needs what, all that kind of a thing. So we'll see. But that was kind of something I hadn't really thought about in that manner, because we've had all this talk about trade talks, and we even had something about discussed a little bit about how Mike Moustakas, you know, who would be in the market for a third baseman, and not many being our thoughts, but hadn't really looked at it from that perspective of, you know, who's going to be in the market, not necessarily who needs a particular position, but just who will be in the market at all, regardless of position. And yeah, unfortunately, not a ton of options for the American League. A little bit opens up a little bit more in the National League, because a lot of got a lot of teams that are bunched up in specifically the East and the West in the National League. Yeah. So that, you know, that, and even the Central, really, I mean, the Brewers have a pretty solid lead in the Central right now, 4.5 games, but then you've got Chicago, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh all within a game of each other. So really, I mean, basically all of the National League right now is in the race. I mean, they don't nearly have the separation.
Except the Padres.
Oh yeah, except the Padres, but they don't nearly have the separation that they do in the American League. That teams do in the American League, because there's no Boston or Houston, or I mean Milwaukee's the closest with their record. But anyway, kind of rambling now. But that you know, I guess if we're to handicap it, I don't know if it's a handicap, but just for your thoughts. I mean, do you think the Royals are gonna trade all those guys? If we talk about Moustakas, John Jay, and Kelvin Herrera and Lucas Duda, those are kind of the guys that we initially coming into the season thought, okay, if they start off well, have a good start to the season, those are gonna be the guys that are really good trade chips. You think the Royals are gonna move all those guys? You think they're gonna move none of them, or how do you think it all shake out? I mean, we still got a couple months, but right now, what's your feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've got a shot to move all those guys. I mean, the question is really just like, and this is kind of illustrated by what you brought up and what Passan was talking about. It's like you might have the best thing in the world, but if teams aren't buying, doesn't really matter. It's kind of what Mike Moustakas ran into. He's a perfectly fine player. He's an everyday third baseman with good power and playoff experience. You know, two All-Star games, but nobody was buying. And, you know, as a result, he had to take, you know, basically a journeyman type of contract. It was pretty rough. But I think, you know, I think it's going to break down into there are going to be a few guys that they can trade before the trade deadline. And then once the whole waiver period comes up, there are going to be a handful of guys that they move after that. And like Duda is probably a key guy like that. You know, I think that's what happened last year as well. The Mets moved him after the trade deadline. And they didn't really get a whole lot for him. Jason Hamill's probably in that same kind of area. Alcides Escobar may eventually end up in that kind of spot. But guys like, you know, Moustakas, I think there's a good chance that a team would want to have him. John Jay, you know, you talk about like the split between AL and really kind of divisions are mostly, you know, accepted as being done. And you might have, you know, Seattle and the Angels working towards a wild card. But John Jay is a lot more of a National League type of player anyway. So, you know, I think
that's basically he spent his whole career in the National League, didn't he, for the most part?
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he can come in and fill in, but he doesn't have to be the everyday guy. He can play multiple outfield positions. I wouldn't be surprised to see him moved ahead of the deadline as well. So, you know, I think that's very much a possibility. You know, I don't know that they're going to get a great return for much of anybody beyond Herrera and possibly Moustakas. You know, it just kind of depends on what happens. And an injury to the right player at the right time can change a lot of that. I mean, the Braves went so far as to try Jose Bautista at third base, which I don't think he'd played that since, I don't know, the 90s. I don't remember the last time he tried to actually play third base, and they ended up cutting him. So they could potentially have a spot for Moustakas if they wanted to do that. But, you know, also a team like the Mariners, they're not afraid to make trades. You know, they are willing to deal with, like, anybody. And they're kind of like my fantasy football league. It's like you kind of feel like you had a bad week if you didn't get at least one trade off. And that's how Seattle approaches things, and that's how they always end up. I mean, I think they've made like 60 trades in 2 years or something. It's just ridiculous. So I could imagine they might be pretty active. I think those guys could all go. It's possible that like Duda, who's currently hurt, if the plantar fasciitis continues to be an issue, yeah, he might be someone who doesn't come back until sometime in July, and then he's got to get right back up to speed. That could really hurt his value and make it really tough for the Royals to get anything of good value for him. It might be, you know, some random minor leaguer or cash or player to be named later. But I think eventually they could move any of those guys, really. I think it'd be pretty easy for them to find at least one taker, even if it doesn't mean that, you know, they don't get a whole lot. So, I mean, I'm tempering my expectations of what return they'll get, because I don't know that they're going to get a lot. But I do think that by the end of the year, most of those guys should probably be moved on to other teams.
Yeah. And I think Herrera's are definite. You know, we kind of identified that from the beginning of the season. And I think he's a guy that's going to get a top 100 type prospect back, and probably should, you know. So that's, yeah, that's going to be kind of the key, the big trade that they'll make. And I do think, I feel like Moose is going to be that that kind of desperation move for another team. There's going to be a team out there who is in the race and wants to make a move, wants to try and make their team better, hasn't made a move, doesn't know what to do, needs an infielder, or, you know, could maybe use a third baseman, or could maybe switch some people around. And so they say, let's go for it. And they just trade Moose. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get a huge haul for him, but I think that's how it's going to shake out for him. And then, you know, I think Duda and Jay, I think have Jay especially, just because Duda's, you know, missed some time. But I think there'll be some good opportunities for both of them to get moved. But they're guys that are, you know, even a desperate team is not going to give you more than just kind of a decent A ball top team, top, you know, team's top 30 prospect type of a thing. You know, I don't know that, you know, I don't know that you'll get much more.
Yeah,
that,
it's just going to be some guy who maybe has some shine.
Yeah,
on
you know, you kind of get like a lottery ticket type thing, or somebody that's kind of one of those high floor, low ceiling types. You know,
yeah,
those seem pretty dime a dozen, if you will.
Yeah, which I mean, yeah, you might as well get something if you can. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. So anyway,
not the most appetizing of trade markets for some of those guys, but yeah, I think there's a shot they move on. You know, the only reason they might not is the Royals literally just don't get any good offer for them.
Yeah,
it's
I mean,
might as well just ride it out.
Yeah, I mean the Royals aren't. I guess with someone like Herrera, you might be in a position where even if you get a bad offer, you might as well take it because you're not going to re-sign Herrera next. Well, I guess maybe they could, but you don't need him this year. And if you can get something, why not? But the other guys, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't really matter too much, you know.
Yeah.
Especially Moustakas, you know, because even though it's a, you know, a mutual option, which is never going to get exercised, it's still, you're still in that position where you can say, you know, well, it doesn't really, if we're not going to benefit that much in the future, then it doesn't really hurt us to just, you know, have some quality players to at least get keep a little excitement going for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I mean, they still got a draw in September, so if it turns out that they don't get a right deal, I mean, nothing says they have to trade those guys. And someone like Herrera, they could potentially give him a qualifying offer. I don't know that I'd expect him to get a $50 million contract.
Yeah,
but
for him.
Yeah. I mean,
if he had had a dominant year last year,
yeah,
like the Herrera that we'd known and was pitching the way he is this year, then maybe.
Yeah.
But after last year's performance, I just find that really hard to believe.
Might scare
that
some people off.
That. Yeah.
But I mean, they could still offer it and get something in a third round type pick for him.
Yeah, that's
potentially,
true.
You know, that under $50 million.
That's right.
So I don't know. I'm interested to see how that goes. But then you have to kind of guess, okay, is that third round pick or even potential first round pick better than someone's top 100, you know, top 100 overall prospect right now? They'd probably lean toward the prospect now. Just because it's more certain. Okay, if we have that offer for that guy, let's take the offer for that guy instead of, you know, condition one, he continues to pitch well. Condition two, we can give him the qualifying offer. He rejects it. He signs, you know, $50 million. You know, there's a lot of steps in there that the Royals wouldn't have control over versus just being able to say, yes, we accept your trade. Please give us Alex Verdugo or whoever it is.
Right.
Yes, we will take that player. I think that's the most interesting. And so far, Herrera's nasty, so that's good. That's a good thing.
Indeed. So with that, we'll kind of – just to recap some other news. Mike, you want to give a rundown of just like some of the kind of roster moves that have gone on this week? Nothing too exciting, but
– nothing too major, but there was some kind of ramifications behind it. Eric Skoglund went on the DL on Saturday with a UCL sprain, which is always, you know, your skin kind of, you know, crawls up a little bit when you hear
mm-hmm.
that. Apparently the MRA was good, so they're going to take a look at him in 2 weeks, see what it turns out to be. You know, he'll probably have a few weeks until he's kind of back. It might even be a month or two before he's back. So the Royals called up Eric Stout to fill his spot on the roster. Stout got hit a little bit hard, so they traded or they sent him down, brought up Scott Barlow. Scott Barlow pitched really well in that extra inning game, which was won by an Alcides Escobar walk-off home run.
of all things.
A no-doubter, too. It was
no,
like
he smoked
jolt.
It.
It was really, like, surprising. It was like, I don't remember seeing him hit a ball that far.
Did just maybe one of the most glorious bat flips in Royals history.
Yeah, he really did. It was pretty fun. And I'm a bat flip fan, so
I love me some bat flips.
I'm glad he did it. So Barlow pitched well. I think he struck out five guys in a row at one point in that game. And, you know, I think the Royals really want to try to stretch him out. But if he's going to be pitching well in the bullpen, it's tough to, like, send him back down. So it's good to kind of see him come up. Blaine Boyer ended up going on the disabled list, which breaks my heart.
I'm sure.
With a back strain, air quotes. Blaine Boyer.
Otherwise known as a case of the sucks.
Yeah. But it also means that Blaine Boyer is still going to be on this team in June.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is weird. It's like this shouldn't have made it past February, but whatever. Trevor Oakes came up. He was going to piggyback the first career start for Brad Keller, who started yesterday. And
I was just going to mention that.
Yeah, and he looked good. I mean, Brad Keller is like, man, we talked about him a bit last week, and, you know, he just, every time out, it's like, you know, he's throwing 95, 96, and that ball's got a ton of movement on it. You can't be more impressed with this guy. It's really cool. And if it means that, you know, his next time out, he's going to beam up to like 75 pitches and then maybe 90 and then full speed ahead for the rotation, that's pretty cool. You know, he'll probably have bumps along the way, but, you know, I think he's kind of coming along about as well as they could have imagined. And, you know, this Skoglund injury really puts him in a position to do something out there, which is, he might be one of the more interesting stories of the summer. You know, who'd have thought that Brad Keller and Jake Junis would be these supremely interesting guys middle of the year, but that's where we're at. And so I'm really kind of excited to see a lot more of him. He really did look really good. The pitch count was kind of high. He kind of got some stuff fouled off and things like that, but, you know, he did fine. You know, I think he's going to be better next time out. So that's pretty cool. And that's pretty much it for moves. There were a few minor league moves. You should go check out Clint Scholes on Twitter to kind of see some of those updates. I didn't really take note of all of them, but some guys moving around here and there. We'll see a lot more of that in the next couple weeks and next 2 months or so as guys get drafted. Next week on Monday is the draft. And then as those guys sign, because the signing deadline's so much earlier that, you know, you're going to have to make room in the rookie and A-ball levels for some of these guys by moving some guys around. So definitely want to keep an eye on Clint's Twitter feed as he updates on those kind of things, and especially during the draft. That's kind of it. I mean, Hunter Dozier, he's starting to hit pretty well. He's kind of figuring things out at this level. Had his first career home run last night. You know, kind of down the line, it's kind of one of those cheapies, but it counts. And at this stage, you know, he's played a pretty decent first base with maybe a couple of hiccups. So, you know, I wasn't quite sure about a lot of the hype of like, oh, Hunter Dozier's this prospect savior. But, you know, he looks like he belongs. He kind of is carrying himself in that kind of way that I'm a little surprised that he hasn't played more at the big league level watching his last week of games or so. So a lot of kind of cool stuff happening. Unfortunately, guys have to go on the DL for some of it to be realized. But, you know, it's positives are positives. And between Barlow, Keller, and Dozier, it's a pretty decent group of positives right there.
Yeah. You know, Keller especially getting that start and looking good. You know, it's definitely encouraging. And while it was nice to have another weapon in the bullpen, if he's someone that can turn into a starter and be
that's
a reliable, it's absolutely worth the switch. So definitely encouraged by that. I hope to see more. And I hope, like you said, they keep stretching him out a little bit, you know, add another 10, 15, 20 pitches each game and let him keep rolling. And hopefully, hopefully he turns into something he can stick in the rotation. That would be fantastic. But we unfortunately, you know, we have seen this kind of play out before, and it hasn't been all that great, to be honest. And when you talk about the Hochevers and the Wade Davises the Nate Karns of the world, and so we've hoped, but you know, hey, Brad Keller, he's a young guy, so he could just be, this is his time and he's ready to go. So hopefully that's the way it is for him.
Yeah, not bad for a trade of cash in this.
Yeah, year. Right.
You know, all you have to do is find a way to keep him on your roster. He's kind of making his own way, staying on the roster right now. So
it's not too hard to find a reason to keep him around as of now.
Right.
So that kind of wraps up the happenings for the week. So now we're going to move into a segment that we're kind of bringing back. If you've been to the show for a while, we've had kind of a deep dive segment where we take just something that kind of is interesting, maybe something we've observed anecdotally, and say, okay, let's look into this. Let's put some data behind this, put some numbers out there and see, okay, is what we're seeing, is what we're thinking, is what we're feeling about a particular scenario situation, is that what's really happening? Are our eyes deceiving us, or are we actually seeing something that's going on? So one of the things that Mike and I had been kind of talking about, you know, a little bit behind the scenes, if you will, just this idea of, not idea, but this, you know, the rise in home runs in conjunction with the rise in strikeouts and what people have talked about recently. And you know, obviously there's been lots of numbers already out there about how the home run pace is for the sheer number of home runs is on a record pace this year. And, you know, last year there was all the juiced ball talk and there were so many articles written about it and, you know, went through the steroid era, et cetera. So, you know, there's all these different times where there's been all these kind of different things that have contributed to what people think is happening. But when we actually look at it, you know, specifically in relation to the rest of what's going on, and this will make a little bit more sense as we start diving in here, but you know, is the home run, are there more home runs being hit? Are there more strikeouts that are occurring? So we went through and tabulated, you know, all the plate appearances, strikeouts, home runs, and hits for every year for all of Major League Baseball since 1960. Okay, so the kind of important dividing line there being 1969, because that was when they lowered the pitching mound after the year of the pitcher.
Yeah, after 1968, where Bob Gibson allowed like 3 runs all year.
Yeah, and I cannot remember now. When did they up it to 162 games? What year was that? Also 69.
They did that in 1961 with the 60, first bout of expansion. Right. Yeah. So we're basically covering the expansion era for all of this, plus 1960.
Right, which was our goal.
Just
we rounded
just
it
for
off.
Round numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, for posterity.
1960 gets added in.
So, you know, first of all, the striking thing there is, so 1960, obviously less games, but there was, you know, 94,000 just plate appearances, right, for all of Major League Baseball. So, you know, less teams and less games is going to throw your numbers off quite a bit. But once, you know, the next year rolls around, we get the expansion teams, we start rolling up the number of games, then you tick up quite a bit from 94,000 to 109,000. And then right after that in 1962 jumps up to 124,000, and there it just kind of steadily increases from there to the point where, you know, last year in 2017, there was 185,000 plate appearances. This is plate appearances, right? So, you know, they didn't lengthen the game. Now, they did lengthen the season, of course, but we covered that, you know, so the majority, even from 1961, though, when they haven't increased the amount of games. Now, there is they have increased the number of teams twice at least, or how many times since 1961 have they increased?
It was 61,
or sorry, three times at least.
Yeah, and 61 then, and 62, they added two teams each. 69, they added four. 77, they added two. And then, of course, 93 and 98, they added two each. So you're seeing a bunch of, you add more teams, so there are more games per day, and, you're getting a larger sample size, really, of more plate appearances league-wide. So it kind of helps build up, the overall idea of what's going on in the league.
Yeah, and so, even still, that's an increase of, from 1961, of roughly 75,000 plate appearances increase per year. So, I mean, right off the bat, like you said, you're increasing the sample size. So that's kind of the first thing to just put in the back of your head and take note of. And we kind of use that as our base, because just reporting number of strikeouts and hits and home runs, that's not really going to get us anywhere.
Right.
Because, like we mentioned, in 1961, there were, 10 less teams. And, when you're operating from that standpoint, of course you're going to have, more games, more players in the league overall. Even though each game is the same length of time in terms of innings, the total number of innings being played, because there's more games and more teams, is higher. So of course the numbers are going to be higher just from a pure number standpoint. So we tried to get some rates that we thought would be valuable. And so, first we kind of looked at, we did look at strikeout rate, home run rate and stuff. But so after the plate appearance thing, where obviously we see the sample size increase so highly, what was the first thing that kind of jumped out at you when we compiled all these things together?
Well, what was kind of surprising is the way that, everything that we looked at is based off of as a rate of plate appearances, instead of, when you talk about batting average, for instance, that's hits based on at bats. And at bats, not all, every at bat is a plate appearance, but not every plate appearance is an at bat. So to just be consistent, everything's based off of plate appearances. And when you look at that, the percentage of hits year to year is generally pretty much in the same range of about 21.7 to about 23.5. I mean, you're looking at,
like, oddly so.
Yeah. And it's like, even with all this talk about how, there are fewer hits, it's, the shift is taking things away, strikeouts don't put the ball in play, the percentage of hits year by year is generally pretty much, I mean, it's not the same. It's not like it's a consistent 22.5, but it's in that same kind of range. We didn't really look at standard deviation, but I mean, they're very close to each other. So
it never dipped below 21% and never went above 24%. So it stayed in that 3% range, and most of the highest years were in that steroid era.
Yeah, and to some extent, that's going to make some sense, because the pitching was really pretty rough. The runs per game was going up, but that it stayed so consistent throughout, despite from 1960, where the game was much different, to 2010. You're looking at basically the same hit percentage. So that was really kind of striking. And so I added another element to this and kind of looked at home runs per hit, when that's where it kind of started to really be like, okay, this is the illustration of how this shift has kind of taken on. Because when you look at it from 1960 to 1993, there are a handful. I'm looking at about 8 years in that stretch where the percentage of home runs per hit is greater than 10%. And every year from 94 on has basically been 11% or higher, with the exception of, couple of years where it's just barely under 11% in 2010 and 2011, and 2014 where it's barely over 10%. But it's never under 10% in any stretch since 1994. So what that shows me is that, yes, the hit percentage is consistent year to year, decade to decade for the most part. But home runs are a greater percentage of those hits. So that's what you're seeing today. And this just, it, I mean, you can look at the numbers and you definitely know that there are more home runs per game, that, you know, strikeouts, there are fewer balls in play. But this really kind of showed me like how kind of dramatic that ends up being once you get into 1994, where, you know, it's so much more, of the way that people are getting hits. You know, they're hitting home runs instead of singles. And that's kind of telling to me about this kind of gradual shift where you're in the 11s and 12s in that home run per hit rate, and now you're jumping into the 13s and the 14s this year. And that's pretty dramatic to me, where it's kind of this slow build, and now it's starting to tick up. So those were the two kind of things that that when I kind of looked at it, I was surprised the consistency of the hits, but you know, I also was kind of surprised how the home runs really kind of shift in that 94 year. It just like it's like a car's going straight on and it just gets bumped and now it's completely on a different route. It's starting to, you know, go in this whole different direction. So I thought that was kind of neat to look at.
Yeah, and it's really, it's kind of funny when you go back through and you think, you know, as baseball fans, you kind of, you just naturally, I think more so than other sports even, we kind of break things up into eras. And, you know, we already alluded to 68, the year of the pitcher. And we talked about, you know, the steroid era starting in 94. And then, you know, the recent years where they've started talking about juice balls and things like that. So it was kind of cool to really, when you put it all together right next to each other, year over year, looking at these rates, you see, you know, it wasn't just our imagination or a factor of anything that, you know, I mean, 93 to 94, like boom, there was a huge jump there. And then from 94 on, it's completely changed baseball. And it's really interesting to see that. And then, but then, you know, you had going into, like 2004, and then that was kind of when they started cracking down on the steroids and everything. And so you saw a little bit of a dip going back down until, you know, you get into, you know, even all the way to 2014, when it was 10%, which is basically the lowest, I think, is that the lowest that it's been since 90? Yeah, that was the lowest that it had been since 94. So kind of funny that 14 and 15, when the Royals made those World Series, were two of the lower home run rates. Well, I guess 2015 was pretty normal, but 2014 was the lowest. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting. But so it's kind of cool to see, like, okay, all these trends we thought and all these kind of earmark years that we set for ourselves and say, okay, that's when this kind of happened and this change, shift happened, you know, it's not just, you know, us kind of retroactively going back and saying, oh, well, we're going to say it happened this year and everyone decides that, you know, there was actually a tangible difference, and that's why people kind of point to those years. So I thought that was kind of fun to really see that with this home run per hit rate. And, you know, we chose not to go into the rates of doubles and triples as well, you know, just because, or doubles and triples and singles relative to each other, because we didn't want to get too bogged down. So just wanted to look at home runs, because that's kind of what everyone, on the tip of everyone's minds right at the moment. But yeah, seeing, you know, especially the last 2 years, when there's been all that talk of the juice ball and how, you know, it's jumped up from 2015 at 11.6% to 13.2%. And then in 2016, and then last year it was 14.4, almost 14.5% home run home runs per hit, or home, you know, home runs as a percentage of total hits, I should say. So that,
that's a much better way to explain it.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's relative to the history of, or not, I guess not complete history, but, you know, the last 60 years, roughly. That's a huge jump, especially year over year. So yeah. It's really quite, quite interesting to see that when, you know, because whenever you see all this talk, you know, yeah, there were some really in-depth articles last year about how baseballs are actually made when talking about juice balls and things like that. And, but you always kind of take it with a grain of salt, like, okay, is this really the reason? Is this just something that, oh, we just think there's more home runs because home runs are a bigger deal now. And we've got, you know, we didn't have Sports Center in the 60s to do the top 10 home runs of the night or whatever the case may be, et cetera. And, but no, it is actually reality in a lot of these cases. And, you know, it's especially stark when you compare it to the point you brought up, which I think was the most fascinating thing from what we found with all our numbers, was how consistent the hit rate has been. It's just, it was, I still couldn't believe it. I had to go back and look a few times, like, are we doing our formulas right and everything? But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it was 22.6% in 1960, and it was 22.7% last year. You know, it's fluctuated in between quite a few, but, you know, comparatively, when you say, you know, you see a 9.9% home run to hit ratio in 1960, and then 14% last year, you know, a difference of, that's a 50% increase.
Mm-hmm. And that's with, you know, over 100, almost 200,000 at bats last year. I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. It's not like it's just a blip. It's like, that's over a full stretch of 30 teams playing 162 games. It's just like, it's a lot of baseball. And
yes,
a lot of home runs in those games. It's just, it's crazy. I mean, that was because we kind of came into this with a pretty reasonable expectation that we were going to find strikeouts jumping up somewhere in the 90s and home runs jumping up somewhere in the 90s. And, you know, that's pretty much what happened. But that hit percentage was really kind of surprising that it didn't jump. I would have kind of thought that it either dropped because all you hear about are strikeouts in the shift, or that you would run into maybe they go up because guys just hit better, you know. But you look at batting average, and batting average is lower than it's been in a long time. So, you know, some of those hits are home runs, but they're not singles. And in the meantime, as they wait for those home runs, they're striking out. So it's that kind of fits with what the narrative of the game is. And it's kind of an interesting pattern. There was a Ted Berg on USA Today a couple weeks ago wrote a story about all this stuff. And his premise is that baseball players are just too good. You know, they've gotten too good at figuring out how to strike each other out. They're too good at figuring out how to hit home runs. And the passage that I've highlighted is, it says, when you step back and ignore for one moment the ways Major League Baseball in 2018 no longer resembles the sport you fell in love with as a kid, that could be the 60s or 90s or whatever, It's all kinds of awesome in a bigger picture sense. The power surge of the late 90s begets more ground ball pitchers, which begets more shifting, which begets fly ball heavy hitting approaches, which begets spin rate driven pitch design to defy those approaches, and on and on and on, except with 1,000 other factors in play throughout. And red herrings all over the place. And it's like, I mean, who have we talked about today? We talked about Brad Keller, quiet, unassuming. Guy throws 96. In 1992, 96 from a 22-year-old kid would stand out hugely. Doesn't right now. You know, it's not to say that 96 isn't a great velocity. It's just that there are a lot of guys who throw 96.
Especially from a bullpen pitcher. You're like, 96, okay.
Yeah, like that's like a starting
point. Okay, yeah, that's good.
The kind of fascination with the guy like Scott Barlow, for instance, is that he only throws about 92, 93. You look at Joaquim Soria over the years. He was a 91, 92, 93 mile per hour kind of fastball guy. Those guys are more and more exceptions. And so, you know, guys are better conditioned. They throw harder. And there's just better information out there. And, you know, I think that's as much a reason why you see strikeouts start to rise. And it's interesting. I didn't even notice this until I kind of looked at it just right now as we were talking. 94 is also the kind of, you know, the alarm year for strikeout rates too. Because we plotted these out on a graph, and there's a point where strikeout percentage, you know, strikeouts divided by plate appearances, 15.88% in 1994. Every year since, it's been higher than that. Every single year has been higher than that year. So to that point, that 15.88 in 94 was the second highest strikeout percentage since 1967, right in the middle of the raised mound Bob Gibson pitcher era. Mm-hmm. So that was the high point, 1967. They lower the mound. You see strikeouts dip under 15% for, you know, almost two decades. You also introduced the designated hitter in that period. You expand a couple times. And then in the 80s, you're around 15% in strikeouts. Then in 94, almost 16%, and ever, ever higher since. So, you know, you can kind of see where the game changed. 1994, that was a pivotal year in a billion different ways.
Yes.
For baseball. The style of the game, the economics of the game, the politicization of the game in a lot of ways. You know, a lot of interesting stuff popped up out of just looking at, you know, a lot of these things. So, some of that is expected, I think. Some of it maybe, you know, I certainly didn't expect to see that 94 note on both home runs, you know, as a percentage of hits and strikeout percentage. You know, that's surprising just as I'm poking around still in the information. So, yeah, I mean, all the urban tales are true. Players are striking out a lot more. They're hitting more home runs. And we knew that, but we can see where it changed more distinctly by what we're looking at.
Yeah, I didn't expect to see that much of a clear demarcation. You know, everyone thinks 94, 95, that era, you know, strike, of course. But seeing how it impacted, like you said, was really kind of eye-opening. Especially with that strikeouts, because now you talk about it's being ever higher every year since, up to 21.6% last year.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the highest, as you had said, it had been in a long time, and it's increased 6% since then.
Yeah.
So, you know, less than 25 years, and you look at the 35 years before that, it was only 2% higher than in 1960, but you know, in the 60s, it was pretty routine to have 15% strikeout rates overall. So, but yeah, it has never even, you know, it blew past that mark in 94, and it's never looked back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably the starkest contrast that we've seen. You know, as much as the home runs change, seeing the strikeouts. You know, I mean, if you talk from 1960 to now, an 11% increase when it started, or sorry, 8%, my math was wrong. 8% increase when it started at 13. I mean, that's like,
you're going from one of every eight batters striking out in 1960 to more than one in every five.
Which is nuts.
It's crazy.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so you might see one strikeout in your first three innings, roughly, in a baseball game. Now you're seeing, you know, one every inning and a half. So, I mean, it's pretty crazy. And when you talk about, you know, what you were saying with that article, you know, how much the game has evolved. And it's interesting when you really think about, like Dale said, to take a step back and say, you know, not only do you have things like, you know, starting to have more approaches geared towards spin rates and things like that for pitchers, but, you know, just knowledge of the game and knowledge of the players who play the game. I mean, I don't know exactly how much or if there was any film review going on in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And, you know, I don't think there was that much. I think that's a relatively new thing. But, you know, now people have, you know, video tech analysts that's what they do. That is their job, is to basically have stats on every single pitcher in baseball that they're going to face. You know, okay, well, this guy against 3-2 counts, this is what he does. This is what he looks for. This is what he doesn't hit, you know, against 2-1 counts. This is what, et cetera, et cetera. And that type of knowledge is going to show itself the most, I think, in strikeouts. You know, I think home runs are more a product of advancements in technology. And by that, I mean, you know, baseball bats and baseballs themselves and just the athleticism of the players. I think the increase in home runs is more of a product of that personally. But I think the pitching is more of a product of the analysis of the game. And, you know, the athleticism and everything has definitely helped a lot in terms of, you know, increasing that overall miles per hour. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think a lot of it has to do with just so much more information about pitching than they had before. Because, you know, as a hitter, you're still, you know, even the best hitters are still kind of at the mercy of the pitchers themselves. Because, you know, you can always just not pitch to somebody. So, you know, the pitcher still has that level of control that hasn't gone away. So being able to manipulate that control in their favor, I think, is something that has really shown itself more in the last couple decades. And we see that, you know, in the rating. And I like, you know, as to your point earlier, we were expecting to see an increase, but the reason why you do things like this is because, you know, we didn't expect to see such a high increase in the numbers. You know, like, okay, if you saw something that was, you know, 3 or 4% increase, that's still noteworthy for sure. But, you know, twice that amount, it's like, man, this is nuts. It really, you know, it's not just not only did it confirm the hypothesis of how much they've increased, but it's just, it really shows how much of a difference it is. And it's even funnier because we plotted all the info on a graph, and you can see the, you know, most of the other lines, you know, they're kind of slowly trending upwards, and you know, home runs might end up a little bit higher than it was, but man, the strikeout line on the graph just shot up in the last couple decades. Pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean I'm looking right at that, and it's like this boop.
Yeah,
but it's, I mean, there might be in a couple of years strikeout rate may be higher than hit percentage. I mean, it's coming up on that. There was some other information from that Ted Berg article, for instance, is that catchers are recording 10.2% more putouts than first baseman.
Oh, yeah, you told me about that.
Yeah, so when you score a game, the catcher gets a putout for every strikeout. 2017 was the first season where catchers had more putouts than first baseman. And this year, it's not just more, it's 10.2% more putouts. I mean, it's just like, that's a lot. I mean, that's just so much. So I mean, it's just a bigger part of the game. I mean, I don't know, you know, I think you're right on like where the technology is, where the analysis is. The example that's always going to stick out to me is just the off-season story of Trevor Bauer, who does a lot of work with the Driveline guys and Kyle Bodey, for, you know, they do a ton of work on, you know, guys who want to add velocity and a lot of different techniques to build arm strength. And they generally get those kind of results. And, you know, that shows that there's this industry of people who are trying to figure out how to add velocity. But the other part is they do a lot on spin rate. They do a lot of cameras. They do a lot on, you know, studying the mechanics that way. And Trevor Bauer this offseason decided he wanted to have a different pitch. And so he just worked at it. And he kept tracking spin rates, and he tracked different grips, and what were the different spin rates on those grips, and what was the different break, the horizontal break, the vertical break, what was the speed, was it coming out of the same tunnel as like a fastball? And he just did all this analysis to basically hack his way into a new pitch, and he's having one of his best years as a result. You know, and it's just like, it's that kind of thing. You look at, you know, Kelvin Herrera added a slider in 2015, and, you know, last year it was a bad pitch, but 2015, 2016, it was pretty good, and it was just something you mess around with and you work on. I don't know how much like statistical work he did to get to that point, but you know, I think they're more willing to try to find those extra ways, because I mean, Herrera could have gotten by with a 100 mile per hour fastball and a really good changeup and still been really good, but he wanted to find that third pitch. And you know, I think the way players and pitchers in particular are approaching those things is that, yeah, they want to find a way to get strikeouts. They want to find a way to avoid the ball in play, because a ball in play can find a hole. A strikeout generally doesn't allow a guy to reach. And, you know, when you get into the whole breakdown of, you know, starters going five or six innings and then you go to your bullpen of flamethrowers, that's another factor too. So I think the structure of the game has changed so much. The information behind the game has changed so much. The incentives of the game. It's probably not a coincidence that a lot of these jumps happen at 94, because in 95, so much more money poured into the game in salaries. And, you know, now home runs are incentivized and people are figuring out how to hit the launch angle, and they're trying to figure out how to, you know, hit fly balls more frequently, and they're worried about, you know, bat speed and exit velocity and all these different things. And, you know, it's like this cat and mouse between hitters trying to figure out how to hit home runs and pitchers trying to figure out how to strike them out. And in the meantime, you've got the shift, and, you know, it's this whole thing of baseball in this really kind of experimental evolutionary period. Which I'm still entertained by it. A lot of people say it's boring, and I see their point, but I still like it. It's still dramatic. You know, the pitcher-batter matchup is unlike so many other things in sports that, you know, I think that it still comes down to that in any era of the game that you're going to find. And so I don't think that, you know, the results may differ, but the central idea is kind of still there.
Yeah, and I think the flip side of what you were talking about too is just as home runs become more valuable, you know, so do strikeouts, because in order to hit a home run, you first have to hit the ball. Mm-hmm. So if you can prevent step one from occurring, then step two doesn't have the opportunity. So they kind of go hand in hand. They'll probably always be intertwined. But something that I hadn't really even thought about until we were, you know, kind of just talking now. So if we go back and just look at 1960, since that's the first year we started, that a 13.5% K rate, strikeout rate, and a 9.9% home run per hit ratio, or home run to hit ratio. So you're looking at 24-ish percent of all balls or all plate appearances where nothing was in play. You know, because it either went over the fence or they never even touched it or never put it in play. Whereas now you're looking at, you know, last year being at 21.6% strikeout rate and 14.4% home run to hit ratio, which means you're looking at, you know, roughly 36% of the time that the ball is not in play. So, I mean, that's a jump of 14. 12% in total of just 12% more times or more plate appearances result in nothing in play. And when you talk, you know, that's an iterative thing, because when you're talking about 94,000 plate appearances in 1960, that's double. So not only do you have 12 more percent, but you have 12 more percent of twice as many. So in terms of plate appearances. So, you know, another thing that people have kind of talked about, speeding up the game, and, you know, game is more boring now. And, you know, while you and I think both will disagree with that, there's at least some element of truth to that for people that say that, because you can say, well, you know, more than 10% and an additional 10% of the time, the ball is not in play. And even though home runs are fun and strikeouts can be fun, you know, I think the most people at heart, if they're a you know, in any way a baseball purist, you like to see the ball in play. You know, exciting things happen. Yeah. You know, Daniel Murphy boots a ball, and you know, the Royals are given life in the World
Series.
Very
exciting.
Yoenis Cespedes boots a ball, and Alcides Escobar gets an inside the park home run. You know, if that's a strikeout or just a normal home run over the fence, we don't see those things happening. So, you know, those are just on a more legitimate basis. You know, Lorenzo Cain going from first to home on a single. You know, I mean, those cool things, those fun things happen, or just, you know, for a non-Royals thing, like the famous, you know, Derek Jeter swiping around the tag against the A's, you know, in the playoffs all those years ago. I mean, things like that happen when the ball is in play. Those are the fun things. Those are the great moments that you see when the ball's in play. Now, you know, like something like a walk-off home run is obviously very super exciting. But, you know, just a home run is kind of like, well, that's cool. We scored, and, you know, it's awesome to see someone hit a ball so far because it's just such a difficult thing to do. But, you know, if you're on the side of baseball's boring now, you know, there's kind of some ammo for that argument when you said that. I mean, that's quite a bit. I mean, just off the cuff, if we round just taking 10% additional of the 185,000 plate appearances last year, you know, I mean, that's 18,000 more plate appearances that resulted in a ball not in play.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just, it's crazy when you think about it. And so, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, most of the stuff, you know, we kind of, as we mentioned in the beginning, we thought a lot of it was going to flesh out like it did in our heads, but the fun part was seeing exactly how much and how it all evolved. So that was a fun exercise to see kind of all those different aspects, and especially once we put them all on the same graph to see how they kind of look next to each other.
Yeah, it's just like it's out of hand in a way. We kind of didn't update the data in about maybe a weekish or so, but at the time that we did this, the number of strikeouts surpassed the number of hits in 2018. So,
wow.
Talking about things matching up, I mean, strikeouts took over at least at the end of one day. So that may or may not still be the case, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, the one thing is, this is just, I mentioned this just because I went through the trouble of looking it up. When we talk about a lot of these things, you know, you look at decade by decade, runs per game have gone up, you know, from 4.04 in the 60s to 4.68 in the 90s to 4.76 in the 2000s. They've dropped a bit now through the 2010s, 20-teens, however you want to refer to that, 4.33 runs per game. I think a lot of that probably, you know, there's an actual ban on steroids. Probably has an impact on it. But you look at all of that, in the end, everything is meant to, like, prevent or score a run. And so a lot of the things that, you know, the kind of purist side, and there's nothing wrong with purist side. It's, you know, the things you mentioned, you know, the ball in play, having the other eight guys do stuff, definitely fun. But for an example, the Royals, for instance, don't strike out much. They have the lowest strikeout rate in the American League. They have the second most hits in the American League. They have the fourth highest batting average in the American League. And yet they have scored the 12th most runs in the American League, which means there are only three teams that they've scored more than. So even with all the hits, you know, all the avoidance of strikeouts, they're still not scoring runs with the rest of the league. And that shows, just to me, that shows that, yes, that might be how you want the game to play, but right now the way to score runs is to, you know, slug the ball. And, you know, even if that means you're striking out a little bit more, in the end, scoring more runs via the home run, via, you know, a higher slugging percentage, has generally been paying off for more teams. And so the Royals are kind of like outside of all of these categories, and outside of all those trends, they're hitting okay with homers. I mean, you know, they're 13th, but I mean, they got some guys who can hit homers. So in the end, the Royals, they're not scoring a lot of runs, and they're not doing a lot of the same things that the rest of the league is. So that's just the Royals as an example. You know, they're not really fitting the mold of what the rest of the league does. And so, you know, maybe that's the biggest reason why they're not scoring a lot of runs. Now, they also lead the league in double plays, so that doesn't help. So they're getting guys on.
It's a very Royals-like thing.
Yeah, yeah. They have an above-average on-base percentage. So, you know, I think there is something to that as well, that they're just not performing once they get guys on. So lack of home runs, lack of power. I think that ties into it too, but you know, so I wanted to compare the Royals to where things are today, and you know, they're definitely lacking in some of the run scoring capabilities that a lot of other teams are kind of sitting at. So it's not necessarily, maybe it's a more interesting game, but it's maybe not a more successful approach compared to other teams.
Absolutely. And, you know, something, as you mentioned, the strikeouts this year overtaking hits so far in 2018, I hadn't even kind of thought to look at, you know, we compared so much about the rates, but then just from a pure number standpoint, you know, what is the delta, if you will, between the difference between hits and strikeouts in a given year? And going all the way back to 1960, you know, there was roughly 9,000 more hits than strikeouts, which going back to last year, there was roughly 2,000 more hits than strikeouts. So kind of crazy to see. I hadn't really thought about that until you mentioned what was going on this year and taking a look at it. And kind of crazy how that gap has closed. And that's, you know, a very recent thing, because hits have stayed pretty close to the same for roughly the last 10 years. So it's those strikeouts that have continued to go up that has closed that gap. So that's interesting. But so yeah, that was kind of our deep dive segment, if you will, for that. Something that we'd been kind of talking about and everyone had been discussing, you know, in the baseball world. So we thought, let's look into this and let's see, you know, what's actually there. We weren't disputing any of the claims, but just kind of wanted to see, okay, how much of it is real and how much of it is imagined. And, you know, most of it is very, very real, specifically in with strikeouts and home runs relative to plate appearances. So kind of interesting. So we hope you enjoyed that. And I don't know if it's something that we'll bring back every week, but when we have an interesting topic that we really want to dive into, we can kind of flesh it out. And if you have anything that you think would be interesting, feel free to hit us up on Twitter, send us an email, whatever, and just let us know. And that's something we can take a little bit of a longer look, excuse me, a little bit of a longer look at and see where it takes us. So that's all we have for this week's show. So thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back next week. Until then, be sure to visit our sponsors. Of course, Kelly's Westport Inn. Always hope you were able to make it out to their annual Memorial Day block party. Always a good time. It was just me and the little one this weekend. My wife was out of town, so I wasn't able to go, unfortunately. But I'm sure it was a very good time, as it often is. But it doesn't have to be a block party to go have a good time at Kelly's, because it's always a good time. At least whenever I go there, it is. So definitely hit up Kelly's and BP Kansas City. Speaking of which, one of the more popular articles we've been having recently, series of articles, I should say, would be Clint Scholes and his analysis of the draft and the Royals prospects, etc. We had him on the show last week, of course, talking about pre-draft things. So the draft will be happening next week, and we're actually going to have Clint on again to talk about what the Royals actually did after we discussed last week what they could do. So that'll be interesting if you're looking to see what Royals got. A lot of picks, going to be a lot of things happening. Yeah. The Royals can get really creative with, they're going to have a lot of money to spend because their draft pool is going to be larger than most teams. They're going to have a lot of picks to use. They can take some chances. They can do some weird, you know, like a couple of years ago when they did the Hunter Dozier, Sean Manaea kind of flip-flop type thing to draft Hunter Dozier first, but give the bigger bonus to Minaya. You know, they can do some more creative things like that if they want. So it'll be fun. It'll be interesting, and nobody has a better knowledge of all that stuff than Clint. So we'll have him on the show again next week, and we'll be talking about what the Royals did. So that'll be a fun prospect-filled show next week that we can talk about. So be sure and come back and see us then. But until then, thank you all so much for stopping by. We'll see you next time. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com.